This is the place where Black is the main character, where we dive into something new like the latest season of Them, The Scare, and the award-winning American Fiction. Or add to the experience by buying or renting the biopic of a legend, Bob Marley, One Love. And add on channels like Paramount Plus and Stars to bask in nostalgia with Beverly Hills Cop and BMF. Explore Prime Video's culture-rated collection and enjoy old-school greats and new-school hits. Restrictions apply. See Amazon.com/AmazonPrime for details.
Did you know one of Nintendo's most prestigious studios, Retro Studios, wanted to make a Final Fantasy Tactics-style Zelda game for the Nintendo DS called Heroes of Hyrule? Retro pitched it to Nintendo in 2004, around the same time they were finishing up Metroid Prime 2, but Nintendo passed on the project, so the game got scrapped early on. Did you know Gaming managed to get a hold of the full 22-page document from former Retro employees while researching the last Zelda video about their scrapped spin-off starring Sheik? Today, we're going to look at Heroes of Hyrule in its entirety. The gameplay, artwork, a story that sounds a little like Breath of the Wild, and some Retro Studios behind the scenes. Let's start at the beginning. Link is not the main character in Heroes of Hyrule, although he does make a surprise appearance as an NPC. After the cover and some artwork, the third page introduces the game's story. It says, 100 years ago, three heroes defeated an ancient evil and sealed it away in a magical book. For many ages, the people lived in peace and freedom, free of the scourge that had tormented them for so long. Until one day, when the book came into the hands of a young boy. A few pages later, there's a more detailed plot outline. Think of it like the prologue at the beginning of most Zelda games, describing events in the past. There's 16 pieces of art in the pitch, but we're going to add some of our own art to help visualize parts of the story that are only told through text. We'll make a note on screen so you know which ones were commissioned by Digino Gaming and which ones were made by Retro. 100 years ago, Ganon captured Princess Zelda, and Link ventured off to save her. But after an ambush, Link fell into the hands of Ganon's minions. Three of Link's friends, who are the titular heroes in Heroes of Hyrule, went on an adventure to rescue him. The three heroes were Dunar the Goron, Seraph the Rito, and Krell the Zora. Dunar's a gruff, tough fighter who embodies the Triforce of Power. He's the strong, silent type, but with few words, he reveals a surprisingly keen intellect. Seraph embodies the Triforce of Courage, and she's patient, helpful, and warm-hearted, while also remarkably brave and fiercely loyal to her friends. She was the first to discover Link got kidnapped, and she was the one who got the heroes together to rescue him. And Krell embodies the Triforce of Wisdom. He's the brains of the party, sort of an arrogant and cynical wisecracker, but that's just an outer shell he uses to hide his soft insides. After many adventures, the heroes defeated Ganon and rescued Link. Then Ganon retreated into a magical spellbook called the Book of Ganon, which he'd previously created as a tool to enhance his evil power. After his defeat, Ganon's spirit got stuck inside the book in a weakened state, similar to how he was trapped in the spirit realm at the end of Ocarina of Time. The heroes tried to burn the book, but it wouldn't catch fire, so they ripped out a bunch of pages and scattered them all over Hyrule to make sure Ganon could never escape. Link took what was left of the book and hid it away for safekeeping. Then 100 years passed. And that brings us to the present, where the game actually begins. The player takes control of a boy named Cory, who gets to know an old man who owns an antiques shop. One day, the old man has to leave town in a hurry, so he asks Cory to watch the shop while he's away. Eventually, Cory discovers a secret room in the shop where the Book of Ganon is hidden. He starts reading the book, which tells the events of 100 years ago, the past, and that's where the tactical RPG elements come into play. Heroes of Hyrule is actually divided into two worlds. Two-thirds of the game takes place in the past as Tactics, and one-third takes place in the present. In the present, you play as Cory with real-time exploration and role-playing. Sort of a traditional Zelda experience, but without dungeons or combat. It's more about exploring the town and interacting with the people who live there. This design was written up in 2004, 3 years before Phantom Hourglass. It never mentions touch controls, so we assume Heroes of Hyrule would have used more traditional controls like the most recent handheld Zelda at the time, Minish Cap. According to the doc, Cory does tasks and favors for the town's residents, like delivering items, searching for hidden objects, digging for treasure, and trading sequences. There's also events and mini-games around town, like a fishing contest, kite-flying contest, a scavenger hunt, and a music contest at the Music Hall. Cory does all these things to earn or discover lost pages of the Book of Ganon, which he doesn't realize is evil. He just wants to read more of the book's legends. After Cory gets a new page, he returns to the book, inserts the missing page, and it unlocks a new adventure in the past. According to the doc, when Cory discovers the book in the old man's antiquities shop, he literally brings the hero's adventures to life by reading the book, and he begins to relive their quests one by one. Now the game switches over to the three heroes 100 years ago, and plays less like Zelda and more like Final Fantasy Tactics, but more puzzle-focused. Dunar's the beefy tank who can lift heavy objects. He's got a hammer for melee attacks, a Deku medallion for summoning a fire spirit, a fire charm that makes all fire sources on the map explode, and a fire shield that makes him invulnerable to fire. Seraph's the fast archer who can fly and change the wind's direction. Her primary weapon's a boomerang that can hit multiple enemies or switches from a distance. She has an invisibility mask for sneaking past enemies, and fire and ice arrows for freezing and burning enemies and objects. And Krell's the long-distance spellcaster who can swim. He can use healing magic, protective magic, boost the party's stats, create tsunamis from anywhere there's water on a map, freeze or thaw bodies of water, and he's got the lens of truth for seeing invisible enemies and hidden doors. The heroes don't start with all of these items and abilities, though. They acquire them one by one over the course of the game. They can also obtain more common items that any of them can use, like bombs, Deku seeds, and fairy jars. The heroes are occasionally joined by cameo characters from past Zelda games. The document doesn't name them, but we're going to assume they'd be personalities fans would like, such as Impa, Tingle, or Skull Kid. Some of the heroes' items also allow them to summon new creatures, such as elementals of fire, water, earth, and air. Unlike other strategy RPGs, Heroes of Hyrule doesn't have experience points or a leveling up system. Instead, there's a heavier emphasis on item collection, like a normal Zelda. Quoting page 12, it's turn-based strategy and puzzle solving. The player controls the heroes and their occasional allies in a series of discrete encounters. Although most of these encounters will involve combat, much of the gameplay in the hero's world is oriented towards solving environmental puzzles in traditional Zelda fashion. Most of the items the heroes can employ have functions in environmental puzzle solving as well as combat. Each adventure isn't just a battle, though. You don't play through one page, then you're done and move on to the next one. Each page is more like an area of Hyrule you can return to later. Page 13 says, each area is divided into several distinct sections, or phases, which are separated by environmental puzzles and obstacles. Much like in a Metroid game, these obstacles act as gates to limit the party's progress until they earn the items they need to overcome the obstacles and proceed to the next phase. This design encourages the player to revisit areas he has already explored in order to advance the hero's quest. The three-phase system would probably be easy to understand during gameplay, but might be a bit confusing as a wall of text. So before we break down how it's explained in the pitch, we'll try to simplify it with a comparison to Ocarina of Time. Let's say Kakariko Village and Death Mountain together are one area. You can enter Kakariko Village unrestricted, but there are some further areas you can't access right away. This is Phase 1. Later on, you get a letter from Zelda, which lets you open the gate in Kakariko that leads to Death Mountain. Death Mountain is Phase 2. In order to progress any further, you have to go to an entirely different area of Hyrule to learn Saria's song, then come back to Death Mountain and play it for Darunia to get the Goron's bracelet. Now, you can destroy the boulder to enter Dodongo's cavern, which is Phase 3. You've gradually gained access to all three phases of one big area, each with its own environmental puzzles, enemies, heart pieces, etc. In this game, that's one page in the Book of Ganon, one adventure. Okay, now here's how it works in Heroes of Hyrule. The pitch doc shows artwork for a sample area, and a step-by-step description for how one adventure plays out. The areas on the map marked 1, 2, 3 are all Phase 1. Dunar uses the Goron gauntlets to move a boulder, which reveals a hidden tunnel underneath. The heroes go through the tunnel and into a nearby tower where they pull a lever to lower the drawbridge. They cross the drawbridge and into the courtyard and fight some enemies. That's the end of Phase 1. There are certain items you need to access Phase 2. The areas on the map marked 4, 5, 6. Seraph has to use the wind charm to make the wind blow north, then she flies over the moat while the other two float across with Deku leaves. Once across the moat, there's more enemies to fight, then Dunar throws a boulder to break a wall, providing an entrance into the castle proper. Inside, they fight a wizard. Then Krell uses his ocarina to bring a statue to life. It gives them the invisibility mask to sneak past some enemies in a different adventure to obtain the fire shield. They then come back here with the fire shield for Phase 3, which is a boss battle against a fire giant. After beating the boss, the adventure's complete. Cori collecting pages in the present unlocks new adventures for the heroes in the past, and the reverse is true as well. The pitch says, completing adventures and battles in the hero's world rewards Cori with new knowledge that he can use to unlock new parts of his own world. For example, the heroes speak to a great Deku tree. Cori later recognizes it as the tree in the center of his own town's commons, and he can now speak to it, although it's 100 years older. Or, after Cori reads about the heroes playing an ocarina melody in the past, he can then use the same melody to win a music contest. There are other items to collect besides just the pages themselves. Many of the book's pages have item-shaped outlines, and by finding items that fit into them, Cori can give the heroes extra health, magic, and so on. The heroes can also find special items, like heart pieces, to permanently boost their max health and magic. There's also equipment to find, like armor, shields, and weapons to raise their other stats, like strength, defense, and movement speed. Clearly, the designers were trying to make a unique hybrid, marrying elements of a classic Zelda title with Final Fantasy Tactics. The document's pretty explicit about that fact, saying, quote, "Heroes of Hyrule is a story-driven game of exploration, puzzle-solving, and strategic combat in the Zelda universe. Designed for the Nintendo DS, Heroes of Hyrule will appeal to fans of games such as the previous Zelda titles and Final Fantasy Tactics." Why do this? Heroes of Hyrule expands the rich Zelda universe with new characters, storylines, and play mechanics. It also injects exciting new themes into the proven handheld strategic RPG market segment, ultimately providing a product worthy of the Nintendo name. Final Fantasy Tactics Advance came out on GBA a year earlier, garnering high review scores and going on to become the 22nd best-selling GBA game of all time, right up there with the Minish Cap and Metroid Fusion. And it seems Retro Studios wanted a piece of that pie. Did You Know Gaming spoke to one team member who was willing to go on record, Paul Tozer. You might remember him from the recent video about Retro's other Zelda project.
I feel the statute of limitations has expired on a lot of this because it's 15 years ago, and I'm interested in telling the truth.
In 2004, Retro had just finished Metroid Prime 2, but they didn't really want to be a studio that only makes one series. Some of them were getting a little burnt out on Metroid, and it's a little risky having all your eggs in one basket. Paul said, "Retro's senior producer Brian Walker was always pushing, like, what's our DS side project gonna be? And he somehow pegged me as the guy who was gonna lead the engineering effort on Retro's first Nintendo DS game." Paul's a big Tactics fan and has some experience designing strategy games. So he came up with an idea called RPG Tactics and pitched it to Retro's higher-ups, but it didn't gain traction. However, Mark Pacini took the opportunity to pitch a new concept. If that name rings a bell, it's probably because Mark Pacini was the lead designer on Metroid Prime, and the director of Prime 2 and 3. Paul said, Mark took a look at that and then said, hey, let's make a different kind of tactics game in the Zelda universe. So from my initial idea of RPG tactics, it evolved into a game that was much more of a puzzle RPG adventure game. When you've got these three heroes, plus the young boy, and you've got to figure out how do I use the abilities of these four different characters to get past lots of different obstacles. It turned into a totally different game. It no longer had any resemblance to RPG tactics. That was just sort of the spark that got this whole thing going. But Mark and I worked together, and I wrote up most of these documents. This was more adventures and puzzles than tactics and RPG, because that's the direction Mark really wanted to take it. 3 years after all of this happened, Tactics Advance got a sequel on Nintendo DS, which again was well received, though not quite as well as its predecessor. If Heroes of Hyrule had made it into full production, it probably would have beaten Final Fantasy to market, and gotten a sales boost thanks to that Zelda connection. According to the document, Heroes of Hyrule would have differentiated itself from other tactics games with four key features: the focus on item collection over experience points, interactive environments, the back and forth gameplay where events in the past and present unlock new possibilities in the other, and the mini-games like fishing and interacting with the town's NPCs. Mark and Paul worked on the project, along with Retro's in-house translator and an artist whose name Paul unfortunately can't remember after all these years. Did You Know Gaming has reached out to Mark on several occasions, but he wasn't interested in talking about old projects. Did You Know Gaming also reached out to all of Retro's artists, but the ones who would talk couldn't remember which artist worked on Heroes of Hyrule. The copy we got our hands on only has a few phrases in Japanese, but Paul remembers physical booklets that were fully translated into Japanese so that they could pitch it to Nintendo. Unfortunately, they passed on the project. Paul said, "We sent it over to Nintendo SPD and got an immediate, 'No, you're not doing that.' To this day, I do not know why. They just didn't seem to have any interest in that gameplay concept, which is too bad. It was a really solid concept and had the potential to be something great. Unlike the Sheik spin-off Did You Know Gaming covered in the last video, a playable prototype was never developed for Heroes of Hyrule. That would have required the green light from Nintendo. So all that's left of Heroes of Hyrule is this pitch document." It's worth noting that one of the meeting rooms at Retro Studios is literally called the Lost Woods. A lot of fans wonder what goes on inside Retro. It's a pretty secretive company, perhaps even more secretive than Nintendo. So we'll lay out their Zelda timeline. They worked on Heroes of Hyrule for about a month and pitched it to Nintendo in May 2004, right around the same time they were finishing up on Metroid Prime 2. Some former Retro guys told Did You Know Gaming a lot of the staff were kind of burnt out on Metroid at this point and wanted to move on to a new series. But Satoru Iwata asked them to make one more Metroid to finish up the trilogy and show the world how great first-person shooting could work with the Wii pointer controls. We're not saying that's why Heroes of Hyrule was rejected. Retro could have made both games, but the point is, franchise fatigue was even worse as they were finishing up Prime 3. That's when Retro spent 9 months programming a Sheik prototype for the Wii, but Nintendo rejected that pitch too. A week or two later, Retro leadership announced that the next game wasn't going to be Zelda. It was going to be Donkey Kong. Paul told Did You Know Gaming, "Leadership basically got us in that big meeting room, sat down, and said, our next game is going to be bringing back the Donkey Kong Country franchise, and that's what we're doing. I'm not going to hear any objections. The decision is final." And I can't blame them for wanting to make that, because I think they spent a lot less to make Donkey Kong than any of the Metroid games, and probably made 2 or 3 times more profit. So I can't blame them from a financial perspective. Paul was really only interested in making Metroid and Zelda games though, so he resigned a few days later. Quite a few other Retro Studios members left around the same time. That's the end of Retro's story, at least as far as Zelda's concerned. But what about the game's story? According to the document, over the course of the game, Corey gradually collects the missing pages scattered around town, not realizing the consequences of doing so. When he inserts the final page, Ganon comes back to life. Ganon's about to kill Corey, but at the last second, the three heroes come out of the book as well, and the four of them fight against Ganon in an epic final battle. After the dust settles, the old man who owns the antiquities shop returns from his trip, accompanied by three elderly friends, a Goron, a Rito, and a Zora. Corey immediately recognizes them as the three heroes from the book, and if you hadn't figured it out yet, surprise, it's revealed that the old man was actually Link all along.
Welcome to Prime Video's Culture-Rated Collection. This is the place where Black is the main character, where we don't jump through hoops just to hear our voice and can fall in love with illuminating documentaries like Giannis, The Marvelous Journey.
I'm just a hard worker that's trying to survive.
Enjoy the animated series, The Second Best Hospital in the Galaxy.
All doctors report immediately.
Where we dive into something new like the latest season of Them, The Scare, and the award-winning American Fiction.
Welcome home, baby.
Or add to the experience by buying or renting the biopic of a legend, Bob Marley, One Love.
I want my music to unify people.
And add on channels like Paramount Plus and Stars to bask in nostalgia with Beverly Hills Cop.
This is the cleanest police car I've ever been in my life.
And BMF.
You're about to take over the whole nation.
Explore Prime Video's culture-rated collection and enjoy old school greats and new school hits. Prime Video, find your happy place. Restrictions apply. See Amazon.com/AmazonPrime for details.
Did you know? Before making the critically acclaimed Grand Theft Auto series, Rockstar North was developing games for Nintendo. In the early 90s, Rockstar, then known as DMA Design, was one of Nintendo's top second-party developers, making titles for the Super Nintendo and Nintendo 64. Among these games was a top-secret project starring one of Nintendo's most recognizable characters. Intended to release on the SNES in 1995, Kid Kirby was a spin-off where players follow Kirby in his first adventure through Dreamland. The game was intended for an even younger audience than Kirby, somehow, and was in production for years, constantly switching its style and staff. Although relatively far in development, the game was canceled by Nintendo for various reasons, and DMA moved on to other projects, eventually parting ways with Nintendo altogether. Despite being part of such an iconic series, there's very little documentation on Kid Kirby Online. ROMs of the game have yet to surface, and the only direct coverage of Kid Kirby in the press was a tiny blurb in a Mexican magazine. So today we'll be discussing the game in its entirety, how it got made, why it was scrapped, and how it may have had an impact on DMA's future titles. Did You Know Gaming has managed to get a hold of several ex-DMA developers involved in the project, and they gave us some valuable insight. Unfortunately, however, none of them have kept any form of ROM, source code, or artwork from the project. So, to help illustrate the game's visuals, we're working with professional game artist Sean Hicks to recreate what could have been, creating accurate mockups based on the developers' descriptions. And we'll credit this in the corner so you know what we commissioned and what's from the actual game. Through extensive interviews and hours of internet sleuthing, here is the story of Kid Kirby, the lost Nintendo game from the twisted minds of GTA. Before we go any further, we should explain where Rockstar North, and by extension, DMA Design, came from. Once you know the roots, Rockstar developing a Kirby game isn't as crazy as it sounds. DMA Design officially began in 1987 in a two-room office above a baby supply shop in Scotland. Founder Dave Jones, a gifted electronics engineer from the city of Dundee, was interested in computing since the late 70s. According to Jones, there was only one computer in his entire school, and he spent as much time as possible on it, much to the dismay of his teachers. However, by the early 80s, home computers became much more accessible in Europe with the rise of systems like the ZX Spectrum and Commodore 64. Jones often hung out at the Dundee Computer Club, where he'd meet three other programmers, Mike Daly, Steve Hammond, and Russell Kay. The four became good friends and began designing small games for 8-bit computers. After losing his job at a manufacturing plant right out of high school, Jones used his £3,000 severance package, about $15,000 USD in today's money, to buy a state-of-the-art Amiga computer. He began working on his first big game, Menace. A fast-paced arcade shooter, Menace was released by major British publisher Psygnosis in 1988. Before finishing the game, Jones sought to create an actual studio after realizing literally none existed in Dundee. The name he settled on, DMA Design, was taken from Amiga programming manuals, where it stood for Direct Memory Access. In Jones's case, it meant Direct Mind Access, though over time, DMA would eventually come to mean doesn't mean anything. Jones quickly began employing his friends from the computer club, and DMA's second title, a spiritual successor to Menace called Blood Money, would release in 1989. Money started to pool into the tiny studio, and Jones dropped out of university to concentrate on DMA full-time. DMA's first major success came not from another space shooter, but a cutesy puzzle strategy game for the Amiga. Lemmings, released in February 1991, had the player guide a gaggle of anthropomorphic lemmings through a series of dangerous caverns. To complete a level, the player must give each lemming, which are constantly moving around the stage, a specific task that will help them avoid any upcoming obstacles. The lemmings can dig, build a staircase, climb walls, and if push comes to shove, self-destruct. Lemmings was a smash hit, selling 55,000 copies in its first day, and opening the gates for dozens of ports. DMA earned more than £1.5 million from the game, about $5 million USD in today's money. And Jones, then only 25 years old, was becoming one of the wealthiest game designers in Europe. The crazy success of Lemmings eventually caught the eye of Nintendo, who wanted to give Jones and his company the contract of a lifetime. While the Nintendo 64, then codenamed Project Reality, was on the horizon, Nintendo started what was known as the Dream Team. In early 1994, they signed several developers and publishers outside of Japan for the 64's launch in North America. Some studios attached included Silicon Graphics, Acclaim, Williams, and Rare. DMA Design, now housing about 36 employees in a swanky upgraded office, was announced as part of the Dream Team on May 2nd. Months prior, DMA went to Nintendo at a trade show, presenting them with something thought impossible. Using a clip from Star Wars, the company proved that full-screen video compression was possible on the SNES. The demo impressed Nintendo so much that they invested hugely in DMA, giving them tons of equipment, like a $34,000 Silicon Graphics machine. Nintendo was also impressed with their work on home computers, and particularly their creative decisions in game design. Lemmings, a family-friendly, cartoony, gameplay-rich title, is exactly the kind of game Nintendo likes. We think Dave Jones is one of the very few people in the world that are in the Spielberg category. Howard Lincoln, then chairman at Nintendo of America, told the press, "His software ideas are incredible." DMA signed a multi-million pound contract to develop two games for the Nintendo 64. The studio also began doing titles for the Super Nintendo. And because of their newfound relationship, DMA decided to reskin a rudimentary SNES game with an original IP into one with a recognizable Nintendo character. The small Scottish studio would become the first developer outside of Japan to work on the Kirby franchise. This was the beginning of Kid Kirby. In the 80s and 90s, there was a trend of taking older, established franchises and babyfying the characters for a younger audience. If you lived during this time, you might remember things like Tiny Toon Adventures, Muppet Babies, and Nintendo's own Baby Mario in Yoshi's Island. Kid Kirby would not be dissimilar to these spin-offs. The game's plot is told from the perspective of an older Kirby who is retelling the story of his first adventure. We open on the DMA logo embossed into the cover of Kirby's storybook. The book opens up, revealing a title card and the opening cutscene. We see Baby Kirby, prominently featured with a long, curly string of hair on his head, waking up from his crib in the middle of the night. He hears a strange noise outside and goes to investigate. He discovers that the Star Rod, the item that keeps Dreamland alive, has gone missing, so now it's up to Kirby to find the magical wand and save the day. Were it to be released, Kid Kirby would have been one of the unique titles compatible with the SNES mouse. Bundled initially with Mario Paint, the mouse was mostly used for puzzle games, art software, and simulations, so it was rare for a platformer to have this kind of peripheral support. In Kid Kirby, the mouse controls a large cartoon glove, serving as a boost for Baby Kirby. Holding the left button, you can pull back Kirby's hair and slingshot him across the level. The further you pulled back, the further Kirby would fly. Think of it as an early version of Angry Birds. When Kirby is mid-air, you can either slap him higher up, essentially doing a double jump, or slam him toward the ground onto the enemies below. Of course, a Kirby game would not be complete without copy abilities. Tapping the right button would activate a power-up obtained from an enemy you recently killed. The stone power, previously seen in Kirby's Adventure, would return in this game, allowing Kirby to turn into a rock and crush his enemies with his weight. There were also plenty of original ideas for power-ups. Kirby could turn into a paper airplane and glide across the level. He could even put on a pair of sticky shoes and stick himself to a wall. Kirby is similar to the titular characters in Lemmings, constantly moving around with a mind of his own. The player essentially serves as a babysitter, a literal helping hand keeping Kirby out of trouble. The goal of Kid Kirby is to collect the lost stars scattered across each world. Once you collect them all, you throw Kirby through a hoop and progress to the next level. There is also an option for a two-player mode, where the screen is split in half and two players race side by side. Kid Kirby consisted of 120 levels, about 60 of which formed the main body of the game. The remaining 60 could be accessed via a hidden door on one of the levels. According to programmer James Watson, who shared his memories of the game in a 2008 forum post, the door was hidden within a large bell. Fun fact, finishing each level would add 1% to the completion counter, and a perfect score required you to beat the game by 120%. Most of the classic bosses from the franchise would return here. Wispy Woods, as always, would be the first boss. King DDD, now a mere prince, would serve as the main antagonist. Enemies included Waddle Dees, Waddle Doos, and Bronto Burt. In researching this video, we contacted one of the many artists who worked at DMA in the mid-90s. This person, who chose to remain anonymous, was one of the original artists on Kid Kirby, where they helped design 3D renders of the enemies and bosses. As well as Wispy Woods, they modeled a Buckethead boss and a Sea Anemone boss. Whether these bosses were original creations by DMA or pre-existing concepts sent over by Nintendo is unknown. After talking to some Kirby experts, we weren't able to find any similar bosses, and the artist, unfortunately, has no memory of what the boss's actual names were. Before working on Kid Kirby, the developers at DMA had a mixed relationship with the Pink Puffball. Some people, like our anonymous artist, were well aware of the franchise, being fans of titles like Kirby's Dream Course and the original Dream Land. Others were the opposite. Programmer Patrick Kerr, who joined the project in May 1995, was initially unaware that Kirby was an existing IP. I hadn't owned any Nintendo stuff because you couldn't program it. I had come from a home computing background and didn't even know what Kirby was when I started. Looking to learn more about the franchise, Steve Hammond, one of the original DMA employees, contacted Nintendo of America for some background information. In return, he received a Monster Facts, which contained character sheets and manuals from previous games. This let Hammond develop a massive internal document called the Unofficial Kirby Reference Book for Westerners. It was a helpful resource for both himself and other DMA employees. Hammond was tasked with writing the game's manual, which laid out the story in a compelling yet humorous manner. The manual was littered with Hammond's own sketches of Kirby, who spoke in an alien language that could only be read as pieces of fruit. This was a reference to classic Marvel comics, where the writers would translate indecipherable languages for the reader's sake. It should be noted that production on Kid Kirby was happening during a hectic time at DMA. Numerous projects across different consoles were concurrently ongoing, and each team consisted of less than 10 core people, often working on several projects at a time. Jones's idea was to try different things, knowing that hits were rare but highly valuable when achieved. At the same time as Kirby, the studio was focused on developing two games for the N64, one of which, Body Harvest, was originally intended as a launch title and was a top priority to Nintendo. Shigeru Miyamoto would often visit the offices in Dundee to consult on various projects. Although Body Harvest was his main concern, Miyamoto always made time for Kirby. He had witnessed an earlier iteration of the game and wanted to add more richness to its playability. Pat Kerr recalls that the power-ups, the paper airplane, the rock, and the sticky shoes may have been Miyamoto's suggestions, though we could not fully confirm this. Nintendo of America had some input as well. The original Prince DDD design was one of the things faxed over to Steve Hammond, hence why it looks so, different compared to the other renders. I don't think any of our guys would have put out something that ugly. In an interview with Next Generation magazine, Jones described DMA's relationship with Nintendo. It's fine. It's hard. It's a very hard relationship because their quality is so high that it's so hard to match the quality of the products they do. And they really want you to focus on making Nintendo products. It's very hard to write games that you're not writing for yourself, which is traditionally what I've done. I write a game because I want to play it. It's a big, big difference when you try and write a game for somebody else. It's really, really hard to do. Kid Kirby was scheduled for release around October 1995, but was in development as far back as 1993. It should be made clear that the Kirby license wasn't always attached. The initial concept came from Tony Colgan, a freelance programmer who previously worked for DMA in the late 80s. Colgan's original pitch was a golf game, the idea being that you could pull the mouse back and strike the ball, shooting through any obstacles that may exist in a two-dimensional plane. Colgan presented Jones with a prototype and was quickly offered a full-time job at the company. It was decided early on that the golf theme should be scrapped and replaced with something more creative, something more DMA. The game had been renamed Jellies. This version had the player control a gelatinous blob with a mind of its own. The goal was to stretch the jelly out and ping them off in any direction, forcing them to land on a series of platforms and escape the level. Bugaboo, the Flea, a ZX Spectrum game from 1983, was a major influence in its design. As part of the early Dream Team negotiations in February 1994, Jellies got exposed to Nintendo, who thought the game would be a good addition to the Kirby franchise, and DMA agreed. The biggest changes afterwards were its visuals. Early on, the game had a more flat aesthetic, with levels built out of large, single-colored blocks. Kirby was initially a tiny 16x16 sprite, but his size grew as the game progressed. At a certain point, Kirby and all the enemies and bosses were redesigned with pre-rendered graphics, and the levels were changed to have a pseudo-3D feel. This change likely happened following the release of Donkey Kong Country, which used pre-rendered graphics on the SNES in a similar manner. In 2007, Mike Daly, another Day One DMA employee, released several Kid Kirby maps and sprites onto his personal Flickr account. The post has since been removed, but is still easily accessible online. The maps give us a good idea as to what kind of levels would have been in the game. There's a cavern, a castle, and a possible boss battle at the Fountain of Dreams. There's also a factory stage with moving girders, as well as a snow level where you'd push through ice blocks to get to the finish. Speaking with Pat Kerr, we confirmed that most of this art was used in the earlier 2D iterations and does not represent the final product. Only two maps, Tube 9 and Sewer 9, would have been included in the pseudo-3D versions. These were the backgrounds we chose to use in our mockups. As the first people outside of Japan to lead production on a Kirby game, the developers had a lot of responsibility. The staff consisted of about 5 programmers, 3 artists, and a single musician. After going through several changes, the game was nearly finished by early 1996. Unfortunately, various complications prevented the game from hitting store shelves. Due to the nature of the controls, Kid Kirby ideally would have been packaged with the SNES mouse. However, due to the SNES nearing the end of its life cycle, it was decided the game should be canceled. Increasingly poor sales of the mouse meant it'd be too expensive to consider releasing. Had it been completed earlier, it could have seen the light of day. But development went much slower than intended, repeatedly being delayed. Things like the basic collision system were far behind schedule, and with so many projects underway, DMA producers didn't have much time to consult. For many people, Kid Kirby was their first professional project. Some programmers and artists were right out of university and lacked the experience that could have pushed the game forward. Tony Colgan, essentially Kid Kirby's director, would be let go near the end of development. This meant it was up to Pat Kerr and programmer Stuart Hunt to complete any unfinished business. Still, nothing could be secured. After years of work, Nintendo eventually got tired of the lack of progress, as did their QA department, and decided to scrap the project entirely in 1996. Kid Kirby was no more. I think the game actually looked fairly nice in its way, but it was just a simple for the kids thing. Probably wasn't taken very seriously by the company, but I was too young and naive to understand that. Shortly after, Nintendo cut ties with DMA. Various complications with Body Harvest, the planned to be launch title for the N64, caused Nintendo to drop the project, leaving DMA to find a new publisher. With one project canceled and another not up to snuff, Nintendo had no reason to pursue further projects with DMA. There is a happy ending to this story, though. While some of the projects DMA was working on in the mid-90s went unreleased and others were flops, some did end up being surprise smash hits. Various members of the Kid Kirby team, like Pat Kerr and composer Colin Anderson, among others, jumped ship to work on another project, a little game called Grand Theft Auto. Mike Daly and Russell Kay have even named Pat Kerr a crucial figure in GTA's success, attributing the game's appeal to his exceptional vehicle physics, which gave it the fun it was severely lacking. The original Grand Theft Auto would release on the PC in November of 1997. Its success was a shock to many employees who viewed it as a troubled project akin to Kid Kirby. It was the start of a new era for the company. Take-Two Interactive acquired BMG, the publisher of GTA and Body Harvest, in March 1998. As a result, several Take-Two employees transitioned to a newly established subsidiary called Rockstar Games. While key personnel such as Jones, Daly, and Hammond departed, the DMA name endured. Under new management, they continued developing games, starting with GTA 3 in October 2001. Subsequently, in May 2002, the company underwent a name change to Rockstar North, a name that has remained unchanged to this day. It wouldn't be a stretch to say that Kid Kirby played a noteworthy part in Rockstar's history, as its cancellation opened the door for many of the original staff on Grand Theft Auto. DMA was going through a chaotic time in the 90s, and it was through this chaos that concepts like GTA could get off the ground. So, next time you're playing GTA, running over civilians and gunning down officers, thank Kirby for making it possible. More specifically, thank Kid Kirby, the cutest pink puffball Dreamland never saw. As of the writing of this video, a playable copy has yet to be discovered. Of all of the people we reached out to for today's video, none managed to keep anything from their time at DMA, as they simply didn't have the means to save their work then. Mike Daly claims to have a demo stored in his archives, but he himself admits it has since vanished. The images from Daly's Flickr account, as well as the rough copies of Steve Hammond's manual, are currently all that survive. But who knows? Maybe one day a prototype will emerge from the archives of Rockstar North, or be found hidden away in a Nintendo employee's closet. Considering the high-profile stuff unearthed in the last few years, it's entirely plausible. Only time will tell.
Did you know? In 2013, there was an internal pitch at Retro Studios proposing that after Donkey Kong Tropical Freeze, their next project should be a Star Fox game. Unfortunately, though, it got shot down by Retro's leadership, so the game never got made. The project has never been talked about publicly until now, and it would have been called Star Fox Armada. So in today's video, we're taking a look at what the game would have been if it got the green light. Did you know gaming staff recently talked to Eric Kozlowski, a former Retro Studios artist who spent 20 years in the industry, working on games like Uncharted, Mass Effect, and of course, Donkey Kong. Eric's the guy that came up with the Star Fox concept, and he gave us the full 12-page pitch document and told us all about the game he wanted to make. The game was aimed at Wii U, and the art style would have emulated the puppet aesthetic that was seen in the series' early promotional images. The Wii U couldn't compete with the PlayStation 4 or the Xbox One in terms of lifelike graphics, but it could produce a believable puppet look that would have had a unique charm that you wouldn't find anywhere else.
You know, it's like, it makes sense. Like retro, like we, you know, at the time rebooted Prime and then we rebooted Donkey Kong Country. And I was like, yeah, we could reboot another Nintendo franchise. Like I thought it would be really cool after Tropical Freeze to roll off onto another franchise and kind of like continue that retro legacy of rebooting Nintendo franchises that hadn't gotten a lot of love.
Star Fox has taken a lot of forms over the years. The more traditional games were on-rail space shooters, while some later entries veered off into other genres, like how Star Fox Adventures was more action-adventure, and Star Fox Command had real-time strategy. But the series was at its height, both critically and commercially, with Star Fox 64. So Armada was going to continue where that game ended, both in terms of story and gameplay. And, very importantly, Fox never gets out of his ship like he did in later games. Quoting the pitch doc directly, it says, "Picking up where Star Fox 64 leaves off, Star Fox Armada is essentially a reboot as if no games have been made since. After the defeat of Andross, General Pepper realizes that Corneria and the Lylat system at large need to be rebuilt. However, the War of Andross has left the Cornerian government with the lack of resources needed to rebuild the military and civilian sectors. Rather than send its meager military out and leave the Lylat system vulnerable, Pepper hires Star Fox once again. Their mission? Search nearby systems for allies and resources. Along the way, though, Fox and his crew will discover a threat far greater than Andross ever was." Going into more detail on the gameplay, the doc says, quote, "Star Fox Armada will combine the classic gameplay of Star Fox 64 with new open world and multiplayer mechanics. In single player mode, players accept missions aboard the Great Fox and travel to planets, sectors, installations, and asteroid belts to complete them. As you finish missions, you will receive money that can either be sent back to Corneria or used to upgrade your ships, or even buy new ones like the Landmaster Tank and Blue Marine Submarine. After each mission, the player will have to decide on how many resources to send back to aid in Corneria's reconstruction, and how much to keep for themselves to spend on upgrading the Great Fox, the R-Wings, buying vehicles, and recruiting new characters." As great as Star Fox 64 was back in the 90s, a full playthrough only lasted an hour, which probably wouldn't fly with gamers in the Wii U era. So in addition to the main campaign, Armada is going to have optional side quest missions. Eric told us that these missions would have leaned more into the mercenary angle. Star Fox have always been mercenaries, but previous games didn't really focus on that detail. Overall, Armada would have had less of a linear structure like the old games, and expanded into more of a mission-based structure. We said earlier that Fox never gets out of his ship. The only exception is inside the Great Fox, where he can walk around in the various decks in what amounts to an interactive menu. Eric compared it to how the Normandy works in Mass Effect, where you can select missions, interact with the crew, and purchase upgrades. As for the moment-to-moment gameplay, it'd all take place on a TV, while the Wii U gamepad emulated the ship's control panel, like showing you information about the current mission and which parts of your ship have been damaged by enemy attacks. If a wing or something's taken too many hits, the player needs to tap icons on the gamepad screen to repair it in real time. In other words, you wouldn't have to constantly look down to aim like you do in Star Fox Zero. If you want to play co-op, Player 1 would use a Wii remote and nunchuck, and Player 2 would use the gamepad, serving as the ship's gunner with a 360-degree view. They'd also handle repairs on the control ship's shields. For example, if a bunch of enemies fly from the left, Player 2 would move the shields to that side and start gunning in that direction. If that style of gameplay wasn't to your liking, you could also play online with one friend or a group to complete missions with multiple ships. There also would have been a battle mode where you could have dogfights with your friends. Pretty much the same thing as Versus mode in Star Fox 64, but instead of a split screen, it'd be a lot of ships flying around online. The reason the game is called quote-unquote Armada is because it encourages you to build up your own squadron. You and a bunch of your friends can make your own team and call it Starhawk, Star Snakes, Star Dogs, whatever you want. It's your team, after all. You'd also have the option of designing your own anthropomorphic characters if you didn't want to play as Fox and crew. There was another, more innovative aspect planned for the online multiplayer. In Star Fox 64, sometimes when you're in the middle of a mission, Star Wolf would show up and attack you.
Jeez! Can anyone take care of it?
Can't let you do that.
That would also happen in Star Fox Armada, except it was going to be the other online players dropping down on you. fans who just wanted to focus on the core single player experience could just turn this off in the options, but for everyone else, enemy mercenaries showing up and obliterating you is something that would happen from time to time. Talking more about it, Eric said,
"You and your friends have your own team of like Star Lion, you know, and you're a lion character, and you know, you could go on multiplayer missions and stuff like that." And I was thinking about the Miiverse of like, you know, you could say, "Oh man, Star Llama came in and took me out. I'm putting up a bounty. If anyone sees Star Llama, you know, like I'll pay them 500 credits in game, you know, to take them out." And I thought that would be like a fun like Miiverse integration, because like Miiverse at the time was really cool and there was a lot of opportunity there.
Star Fox games haven't sold too well since the N64 days, so a big part of this pitch was selling management on Armada's financial prospects. All the online features were one of the main selling points to keep fans playing after they've already finished the main campaign. The pitch doc calls this an evergreen title, and also mentions DLC, which was intended to bring fans back for more by adding new ships, missions, and planets over time. Nintendo didn't really have any evergreen titles in 2013, but Splatoon sort of filled that niche when it released a couple years later, and it's been incredibly successful ever since. The doc says, quote, "Star Fox has a great legacy, but it can be so much more. This can be Nintendo's very own Star Wars. It's Team Fortress 2, in regards to the online community. With the proper updates to the gameplay, Star Fox is poised to stand shoulder to shoulder with Mario and Link. In an alternate timeline, maybe Nintendo's premier online game could have been Star Fox instead of Splatoon. Or of course, you know, there's no reason both series couldn't have lived side by side." So why didn't Star Fox Armada get made? Eric pitched a document to Retro leadership in January 2013. They basically said, "Oh, cool," and then passed on it. And it doesn't appear it's ever made its way up the chain to Nintendo. Eric told us Retro's leadership and Nintendo producer Kensuke Tanabe would ultimately decide on what the best direction is to go for the studio. I'm sure they were talking with Nintendo of Japan about what makes sense for the studio to work on based on personnel, Nintendo's portfolio of games in development at the time, and what the studio staff wants to work on at the time factors into it a bit. But ultimately, a lot of those decisions came from Japan. Eric ended up resigning from Retro a year and a half later, partly because of the studio's top-down nature. Other studios he's worked on had cultures that were more open, where pitches stand a chance of being turned into actual games. When we talked to Eric, he emphasized that this was a skeleton of a document, which would have needed fleshing out from all the brilliant people at Retro. Unfortunately, though, internal pitches just never got approved at the studio. We heard similar sentiments from other former Retro employees. Check out the recent video on Metroid Tactics, for example. Fortunately for Eric, though, he's since moved on to greener pastures where things aren't so hierarchical, worked on properties like Resident Evil. As of this video's publication, Retro Studios hasn't released a single game since Donkey Kong Tropical Freeze back in 2014. So after rejecting the Star Fox Armada pitch, what did they work on instead? Eric wouldn't say. After Tropical Freeze, Eric spent a year and a half working on a game that was never released, and that's all he was willing to divulge. Whatever Retro was making, it's still considered top secret. As for what happened to Star Fox, Nintendo later teamed up with Platinum Games to make Star Fox Zero, which unfortunately ended up as the worst selling game in the entire franchise. This was 8 years ago, and there hasn't been another Star Fox game since. Fans are still waiting for the day that Fox will make his triumphant return, whether it's a reboot from Retro, or maybe in-house at Nintendo. Hopefully that day isn't too far off.
Did you know there's an official Gen 3 Pokemon game that's completely lost to time? It was called Pokemon Garden, and you're watching footage of it right now. It had some original music, and even had voice acting. Pokemon Garden was only released in Japanese, but as of this video's publication, it can't even be played in Japan, or anywhere else for that matter. But there's a team of archivists who spent the last few years trying to recover it and make it playable in English. We'll talk more about that towards the end of the video, but for now, let's discuss the game itself. Well, actually there's four lost games we want to cover today, but we'll start with Pokemon Garden since it's our favorite. By the end of Gen 3, Game Freak and Nintendo were seeing a pattern. Each new generation sold significantly less than what came before. Older fans felt they'd grown up and didn't want to play Pokemon anymore, a phenomenon Game Freak called graduating. Meanwhile, the series was failing to pull in a younger audience who could take their place. So they partnered with Bascule to make Pokemon Garden, a game primarily targeted at Japanese elementary students. It also aimed to bring back older fans by kicking off Pokemon's first large-scale web campaign. The whole internet thing was relatively new back then, so this was Pokemon's big online blitz. So even though Pokemon Garden looks like a Game Boy Advance game, it was never put on a cartridge. Instead, it was only playable on a computer through Yahoo Kids Japan. Pokemon Garden launched on July 7th, 2006, a few months before Diamond and Pearl released in Japan. It started like any other Pokemon game, asking what you want your name to be, but it also goes a step further by letting you choose your trainer class. Then you march up to this four-story Game Boy building where the rest of the game takes place. The first floor is the lobby, where you can schedule your appointments to ride the Pokemon Time Machine. There is at least a 2-hour wait time for the machine, so until then, you can read Pokemon news updates or play mini-games on these arcade machines. They record high scores just like real arcade cabinets, so if you're good enough, you can make a permanent impact on the world. At the scheduled time, you'll get a call telling you to climb aboard the time machine. You'll get your pick of the Diamond Tour or Pearl Tour.
Yo, minna, omatase! Ore wa Pearl Go Guide no Kazuya!
Atashi wa Jun da yo!
Pokemon Special Tour,
welcome! You'll be joined by 10 other people playing online just like you, and taken to an interactive tour of Pokemon's history. Each tour lasts about 30 minutes. Depending on decisions you make as a team and how you react when the time machine malfunctions, events can play out a little differently. So therefore, you're encouraged to ride it again and again. After you safely return to the present day, all the passengers take a commemorative photo together.
Hi, cheese! Minna, Pearl Go no tsuwa ni sankashite kurete, thank you!
Then you can ride the escalators upstairs to the gallery. You can actually see the lobby below through the gallery floor. There's three doors, and behind each one is a gallery dedicated to a specific region. The Kanto Gallery, Johto, and one from Hoenn. Each room has music specific to that region, and comes with an upper balcony room. Inside you can see official artwork including concept art, maps, character art, and you can read about the Pokemon native to each region. You can also chat with other people in the gallery, who are actually other people playing online, not NPCs. Game Freak's office is on the third floor, and you can poke around and watch the developers working hard to make Gen 4, or chat with the devs like Junichi Masuda and Ken Sugimori, who share trivia and show you silhouettes of Pokemon who haven't been released yet. Interestingly, some information they shared turned out to be not true, like that Sinnoh starters would be Fighting, Dark, and Psychic types. In their offices, you can check out the developers' Pokemon teams and watch videos of them, like this one of Sugimori drawing Gengar. There's also a Pokemon quiz if you want to test your trivia, and a couple of hidden rooms you can only access with secret passwords. If you sleuth your way into the secret diamond room, you could download this exclusive wallpaper for your computer background, and you could get this one in the Pearl Room. The fourth floor is a souvenir shop where you can buy stuff like emoticons and stickers. To earn in-game cash, you'll need to play the arcade machines in the lobby or enter tournaments on the top floor. Well, maybe top floor is not the best way to describe it. It's more like the inside of Pokeballs on the building's roof. They open up and each one is as big as a stadium inside. These tournaments are essentially rock, paper, scissors. But instead of rock, paper, scissors, you use Pokemon types. Water beats fire, fire beats grass, and so on. Winning against other players gets you in-game money, and if you beat enough opponents, you take on NPC Game Masters. There's a lot more to it, but we don't want to bore you with every detail, so that's the long and short of it. Looked at as a whole, Pokemon Garden amounts to an interactive Pokemon museum and theme park. It was initially scheduled to shut down 5 months after it opened, but it was extended another month due to popular demand. A lot of the footage in this video comes from a press release made for investors, which boasts of Garden's million-plus visitors and even attributes to the success of Diamond and Pearl to this unprecedented online campaign. Diamond and Pearl broke the series' downward sales spiral and managed to outperform both Gen 3 and the Gen 1 remakes. How much of that can actually be attributed to Pokemon Garden is impossible to say, but this investor video sure seems to think it played a big part. Garden was so popular, in fact, that after it closed, it was reopened again. This time permanently, they said, but interest tapered off as time went on, and so it was eventually closed forever. However, as we mentioned earlier, there's a group of preservationists trying to resurrect it once again and make it playable in English. It's some of the same folks who recently released fan localizations of Pokemon Mystery Dungeon Wii games that only released in Japan, which you could play right now if you wanted to, thanks to these guys. Unfortunately though, restoring Pokemon Garden's a bit trickier than localizing Pokemon Mystery Dungeon Wii. Garden was technically a Flash game, so the only way to restore it is to find fans who played it 15 years ago and ask for their browser cache. And we're not talking cache as in money, an internet cache is essentially a computer's stored data of websites it accessed in the past. The preservationists use them like puzzle pieces to put the game back together, but it isn't easy finding people with computers that old that are still working. And one person's cache is only part of the picture. With their project leader, MVIT, translator Higsby, and a few researchers, they've made good progress, but 100% completion's gonna be impossible without community support. That's why we made this video. If you ever played Pokemon Garden, please visit this link. Or, if you know anyone else who played it, ask them to visit this link. It's called Flashpoint, and it'll check your browser cache for Flash games so you can donate them to all Flash restoration projects, including this one. Hopefully someday soon, Pokemon Garden can be restored for fans all around the world to experience firsthand. There are three more lost Pokemon games they hope to recover as well. After Garden's closure, the official website announced Pokemon Maze Land, a comparatively simple game where you run through Pokemon-shaped mazes. Any Pokemon from Generations 1 through 4 were fair game, and every day, fans could explore four of them. In each maze, you're supposed to find four checkpoints, collect plates, and you can even chat with other players. There's still a lot of missing information about this one because not as many people played it compared to Garden, so there's fewer internet caches recovered. Another game was Pokemon Sky Tower, which launched side by side with HeartGold and SoulSilver, and was seemingly inspired by the real-life Skytree in Tokyo. Long story short, it's a Pokemon trivia competition that uses info from the first four generations of Pokemon, hosted by this guy in a Burmy costume. You compete against other players online, and for each correct answer, you ascend one floor of the Sky Tower. Get one wrong, and you go down a floor, and the first one to make it to the 100th floor wins. The game was only playable from 6 a.m. to midnight, and the tower had a pretty cool day-night cycle. There's a lot of missing data and information, but it's worth noting that Maze Land and Sky Tower both had online leaderboards. The last game is Pokemon Dream World, which unlike these other games, did originally release in English. It was also technically a Flash game, but it had the ability to connect directly to Pokemon Black, White, Black 2, and White 2. You could even send Pokemon from your DS into Dream World to collect exclusive items and catch new Pokemon, including some Pokemon that you couldn't catch in a Generation 5 game. Probably the best way to describe Dream World's like a simpler Pokemon version of Animal Crossing. Each player had their own customizable home where they could visit other players' homes as well. Unova doesn't have any soft soil for growing berries, but you get your own berry garden in Dream World, and you could send berries back to Unova. You can unlock new areas in the Island of Dreams like the Windswept Sky, Sparkling Sea, and Spooky Manor, each with their own mini-games, Pokemon, and items to collect. Pokemon and items collected in the Dream World could be sent back to the DS games, and every Pokemon had hidden abilities. For a lot of them, it was actually the only way to obtain those abilities. Some were unlocked for free, while others cost Dream Points earned by playing mini-games, making friends with other players, and watering berries for them. That's nice. The Dream World also appeared in the Pokemon Adventures manga, as an alternative dimension that Pokemon visit in their sleep. The game was shut down early in 2014, the same day as all of Gen 5's online functionalities, rendering it completely unplayable, just like the other games that we talked about. Again, if you ever played Garden, Maze Land, Sky Tower, or Dream World, please visit the link to share your Flash cache. It can mean the difference between these games getting resurrected or languishing in the afterlife for all eternity. If they're ever brought back from the dead, we'll be sure to let you know in a future video.